We have a lot of things in our lineup this fall. Somehow it seems to be all South Africa or all mines and iron ore. It's an amazing kind of confluence. But let me at this time hand it over to Kurt, and he's going to introduce our wonderful speakers.
Thank you, John. Great to have you out and joining us on this beautiful fall September day. I really feel privileged today to be able to make this all come together. As of last night, we picked up 9 of our South African Museum and Cultural Heritage and art specialists from South Africa who are beginning what will be about a 10-day visit here in the United States. And for many of them, it's the first time they've ever been in the U.S. And every one of them, it's the first time they've been on our campus. So the fact that they were so weary after those long flights last night and that they were willing to get up and do something for us, a couple of weeks ago we said, Would you be willing to do a talk about the making of the Lwandle Migrant Labor Museum? Because two of the individuals who you're going to hear from have been really critical to the development of this museum outside of Cape Town, and you're going to hear more about it today. But I also wanted to just say that the reason that this delegation is here is that we are working in partnership with a number of South African museums and cultural heritage organizations and foundations, including the Desmond Tutu Foundation that's represented here, on a variety of different projects. And we've been doing this over a long time through the MSU Museum and through African Studies Center and Matrix on campus and many other partners, including our history department. And as a result of that, we were able to secure one of the new MSU Alliance for African Partnerships grants, which is really helping us advance our efforts in co-creating new initiatives that are built on principles of equity and transparency and really sharing our knowledge as good partners. And so I'm not going to say too much more than that, except one more thing, which is that you're going to hear from two of these individuals today. But if you can't get enough of South Africa, and for some of us, we just can't, tomorrow over at the International Center, sponsored by the African Studies Center, we're having a presentation by each of them is going to briefly talk about their institutions, the current state of their institutions, kind of where they're at and where they're going. So that's at noon tomorrow in 301, I believe. Wednesday. I'm getting ahead of myself. Thank you, Lisa. She was panicking. I wondered why she was panicking. Wednesday, yes. So please plan to join us and pass the word, if you will. So let me begin. I think we're going to start in the order of how this all began. Our two featured speakers today, though, first you'll be hearing from Bongani Majima, Bongani was one of the founders of the Lwandle Migrant Labor Museum, and has since gone on to become the director first at Rhodes University of the Albany Museum, and now is the director of the Stellenbosch University Museum in Stellenbosch, South Africa. And then you're going to hear from Masa Soko, he's more than the director, he's the CEO. I guess if that makes you feel he's more important. And then we're going to hear from Masa Soko, who is the project manager of the Lwandle Migrant Labor Museum. So please make them very welcome here today. We told them this is not, they don't have to then read a paper, it's not all that formal, but they're gonna, I think, provide you an interesting history and an opportunity for you to ask questions too. So, Bongani, please join me.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I don't normally give talks. Because as some of you know, in museums we tend to hide behind exhibitions. We let the exhibitions talk on our behalf. So it kind of gives us diplomatic immunity of some sort. So I feel like my diplomatic immunity is not activated. Colleagues, thank you very much, Kat and Marsha, for inviting us. And I would also like to thank the Alliance for African Partnership for inviting us. I must say that you have a beautiful campus. It's very nice to be here. And I feel like I'm at home because I can see a lot of people that I know. John there at the back. I also know John from our interactions. Lisa, of course. Mark, I think we are Facebook friends. I'm feeling more at home. And whenever I speak to people here at Michigan, everybody's doing something on Africa. I feel like this campus, you could actually take it and put it in South Africa, and it wouldn't look like an American university at all. It would look like a South African university. All right, I'm here to talk about the Migrant Labor Museum, reluctantly so, but we've agreed. You know, as South Africans, we always reach an agreement that we will divide the task because I am the past of the museum, and Masa represent the present and the future of the museum. So if I talk too much about the past, don't think it's because of my age or anything. It's because of the agreement that we had. Before I start talking, because this is a topic that's really personal to me, because my own father was a migrant laborer. And when I entered the space, I was very impressed by that artwork at the back, because it says everything that I want to say in visual terms. You can see there is farming there. My ancestors were farmers. There is mining. My grandparents were miners, were migrant workers. So that painting actually captures almost every, and I'm happy that it's in here in this space. I hope, Mark, it will become a permanent feature of this seminar because of its importance. All right, let me kick off. This is a very special museum in many ways. It's the first township-based museum. In South Africa, a township is an area that was reserved specifically for blacks. It's unlike township elsewhere. I think in other areas, a township is something that is for the middle class. But in South Africa, it means it's a working class, poor-resourced area. And so this was the first ever museum to be in a township. And at the time we established it in 1998, there were no models in South Africa to use, because it's something that has never been done. All the museums were in the city center. They were all dedicated to white histories, and where black histories were presented, it will be the indigenous people. They were shown as primitive, with their bows and arrows, et cetera, et cetera. So black South Africans were never depicted as citizens of a modern industrial economy in a museum sense. So this museum kind of reversed all of that, and there was no template. We didn't even know how to do it. So it started when the government in the late 90s, as you know, we had a new government. Nelson Mandela was the president. And in the 1950s, Masa, you'll remind me, I don't want to rehearse the whole history of South Africa because I assume that you know it. In the 1950s, in Lwandle, which means the sea, basically, there were hostels that were built for migrant workers. The difference between the migration you see now and the migrancy that we had in those times is that it was forced migration. Black South Africans had to carry a passbook, and to be in the city center, they have to justify their presence by being employed. So if you are not employed, you are not allowed in the urban area. Otherwise, you stay in the reserves. And there was a lot of control. Your stem must be stemmed by the employer, and your movement was controlled. And then people were not allowed to bring their families, so they were single male hostels. I don't know how I can give you a picture, but some of you who've been there, you understand what I'm talking about. So in the hostels, there were no rooms. It was an open hostel. You only had one bed on the side, and then the other male on the other side with the bed. So there were bed spaces, and there was no privacy at all. So this museum is just one of the two that is dedicated to workers, other one being in Johannesburg, the Workers' Museum. and this one being in the Western Cape. It's housed in what used to be a community hall. I'll tell you briefly a history of how it happened the way it happened, because it's got its own history. And then we've also managed to secure a hostel, the original hostel, where migrant workers used to stay, and it's preserved. We've got funding, you know, like, this is almost like U.S. is almost like our family, because funding came from the ambassador's fund, the U.S. consulate in Cape Town, to conserve that unit. I think it's the only museum I know of that commemorates migrant labor. I stand to be corrected, but as far as I understand, I don't know of any museum in the world that commemorates migrants and migrant labor, but I stand to hear if there are other museums. The situation of strand is a Dutch word for sea. We've got a version of Dutch called Afrikaans. It means sea. So Luanda is just a translation of that word sea, because strand is located near the sea, on the, not the beachfront, but the sea is not very far. Massa has traced the history to 1958. I think the first hostel block was built in 1958. Most of the hostels in South Africa, there was no planning. There was just one template. So if you go to Joburg, it was replicated all over the place. It has to be very far from the what was reserved as a white area. And the hostels were designed in such a way that even if they were to grow, they will never become part of the city. You know, you have a railway line separating the CBD. Sometimes it's a road, sometimes it's a buffer zone. But I'm sure some of you would have come across that literature on apartheid urban planning, because that's an area on its own. As I have mentioned, migrant workers, so you couldn't see, there's an, Kat, you'll remember, there's a huge national road. Then it's called the N2 between Cape Town and the Overberg. At that time, if you were traveling on that road, you wouldn't know that there is a black single hostel. It was hidden. It was by design, not by... It was all deliberate. So children were not allowed. There were no schools. There was nothing. It was just only single men who are working. So in 1998, Shamian Plummer and myself, Shamian Plummer was doing, I'm going to give you oral tradition, talk from the heart and not necessarily from the head. So in 1998, Shamian Plummer and myself, we met because there were all these developments that were happening. And Shamian Plummer was doing a lot of work in the township. She established a preschool. And she wrote to the municipality to ask them to preserve one hostel so that the story of migrancy shouldn't be forgotten. And then we met together around 1998. And at that time, there were changes within the local government as well. The municipalities were being amalgamated. And they were not sure where to locate the project. And we started as volunteers, and we thought maybe within 6 months, the government will take over the project, will just drive it. But it ended up becoming a full-time permanent thing. And it took years before it became a government museum. So we worked with Shamian Plummer with no funding. You know, nobody, you know, workers' history is not a sexy thing. It's not something that government is excited about. So there was no funding at all from government. We had to raise funds. I remember the first funding was like 15,000. That we received. And everybody was excited about it, but there was no funding to do it. And the most important thing is that when we opened the museum on the 1st of May, which is International Labor Day, the hostel that we wanted to preserve, it was occupied by the people. There were people staying in that hostel. So now we had to negotiate with the people to move. And accommodation, because this area was reserved for single migrant workers. And then in 1983, the pass laws were lifted, and there was a huge influx of women and children. So if you have a hostel block that was designed for 10 males, you'll find out that there were 50 families staying with their children in that cramped space. You know, so you can imagine there was no privacy. So the women, they started to demarcate the hostel using curtains. as a way of providing privacy. I remember our first exhibition we titled Raising the Curtain when we did our first exhibition. So when we opened it, the hostel was being used and it was unethical to kick the people. You know, you must compare what comes first, accommodation or the museum. And now we negotiated with the municipality to give us the old community hall, which was not used at that time. And then we established our presence there while negotiating to acquire the hostel building, because there were people staying in that hostel building. And it took, I don't know how, maybe Masa, you'll mention how long it took to get that hostel. But eventually the people were moved to better accommodation after, I think, 10 or 15 years of negotiating. So I learned from that making a museum is not an event. It's a process. It takes a lot of time. There is a lot of negotiation. There is a lot of give and take. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but it's the process of making a museum. So when we opened, we had this exhibition that I mentioned, Raising the Curtain. It was not done with any funding. We simply negotiated with people. Some people gave us photographs. Some people, I negotiated with photographers from Somerset West. They donated, they came, they took the photographs around the township, and then they donated. Sometimes they have to even pay for developing the photographs. We had it. It was a very homemade exhibition, but it actually kind of gave us a sense that the museum was becoming real. In fact, even before we put up an exhibition, you won't believe this, the German tourists were coming and there were empty walls on there. There was nothing to show them. So I was telling them, this is what we are going to do. And they were fascinated by that, but there was nothing to show them. So this is how you make a museum. Then we started the museum without funding. I was not paid. I think I wasn't earning a salary for all the years I was there. I think I was earning about 300 as a stipend at some point. You know, it was not easy, but I think it was something that was very closer to my heart. And if it was not closer to my heart, I wouldn't have done it. And Charmian Plummer was also involved because she loved the project. So now you come to a working class area. You come with a colonial concept called the museum. Nobody in the township knew what we were doing. So we had to explain to locals what is a museum, because they didn't understand what a museum was. Because those who did understand the museum, maybe they have seen it in town, it had bushmen, and now you say you are not going to have bushmen, you are going to have their own history. It was difficult because they never saw themselves as people who could be represented in the museum. Secondly, they never thought a museum in the township is the same museum as you get in a CBD, for example. So it was difficult to explain this concept. And they really couldn't understand it in the beginning. And for them, the past was not something that was urgent, because for them, getting a job, getting better accommodation was the most pressing issue. So now you want to take this hostel when we do not have housing and you want to convert it into a museum. They couldn't understand that, because they thought their immediate need was to get accommodation. So it was not an easy journey. People were very unemployed, and some thought maybe if it's done, it will create a lot of jobs. There will be a lot of tourists flocking in. Dollars will, you know, there will be a lot of money. So there were a lot of expectations which were really unrealistic. On the 1st of May, there was a misunderstanding when the project was launched. The residents, they gave the museum permission that the hostel block will be used as a museum, but on condition that they are given alternative accommodation. That was clearly explained. But you know, people being people now, they see cameras and media. So they wrote a huge placard on the opening day that we do not agree with you that this must be a museum. Give us accommodation first. And some people didn't understand the context. It was a way they saw the opportunity that now that there is a focus on the museum, then their plight of getting accommodation will be accelerated. Yeah, and so there was it was very embarrassing to the museum at that stage. But it was not against the museum as such, but it was a protest to get better accommodation so that the block could be released as a museum. So that sign is now part of the exhibitions as part of the process, because we don't want to make the process of establishing a museum simple, because people are going to think it's a simple process. You just get a building, you get everybody excited. It's not like that. And then, I don't think I'm going to rehearse the whole story about the history of the museum, which I have already done. I think at this point, I will allow my colleague Masa to talk about the present and the future. I think most of the stuff that I'm able to say, it will come during Q&A. You are welcome to engage. I want to thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Masa. I am the museum manager, and I'm just going to continue where it has been left off. So at the museum, we offer quite a lot of things, but I'm going to talk about a few of some of the things that we offer, and that is guided tours through the museum and Hostel 33, which Wongani has spoken about. Now, the guided tour of the museum, it starts off about the chronology of Lwandle, of when it still was a farm which belonged to CPJ Van Vuuren, to the development and the coming of women in 1986, making the area to be overpopulated and a development of informal settlements around the hostels, and then the petition that was done by our neighbors in Strand in 1986 to have residents of Lwandle evicted and sent to Cape Flats because they were causing an economical problem in Lwandle. So we do a walk in Lwandle where we take you to Hostel 33, which is the only remaining hostel still in its original form as it was used during the migrant labor period. And then we take you to one of our historical sites, like the first school that was built in Lwandle, sites like the Fakela Square, and then we take you through our local business center, and then we come back to the museum. Now, we also do a number of education programs, the local history program, which focuses on the history of Lwandle, and we do that mainly for grade fours and grade six. And then we also do an indigenous medicinal plants program, which focuses on medicine that we use. Now, the migrants that were staying in Lwandle, as he has mentioned, there were no hospitals or clinics for them, so they depended mainly on herbal medicine. So what we did at the museum is that we made a garden with all the indigenous medicinal plants. So when the students come for the medicinal program, they get to see the plants, they get to taste the plants, and they get to make their own medicine as part of that program. We also do the National Symbols program, which focuses on their citizenship in South Africa, the national flags, the plants, the animals, the symbols, and all of that. We've also worked with Iziko Museum with the slavery project. We don't run it as yet, but we're working with them to try and develop a program for the museum that will focus on slavery. We also do other programs such as the Youth Connect program, which we just launched in July. That is when we get young people to come to the museum and speak about museum issues, community issues, and young people's issues in general. So we hold debates for them. We do career expos, and we're hoping to develop an ambassador program with them where we can take them to different museums that we've worked with, Robben Island. So we're working on that with them. So this is just a couple of pictures of some of the programs that we do. So we make teachers packs. For the programs where we do, they have to answer questions, they have to draw, and then the other picture there, that is them mixing and tasting the medicines. And we also have a project called Theatre Fridays. Now, since the museum was new, if I just go back to history and people not having a clear understanding. Over the years, we've managed to get some of the older generation buying into the museum. But now we have the younger generations. So we're trying to bridge the gap that is there. So we've launched a couple of programs, just like the Youth Connect program, as well as the Theater Fridays. Now with the Theater Fridays, we're working with the Guyakanya Production Group, which does performances. So they do performances based on history of the area, but they also do performances based on entertainment. So that is one of the plays that they were doing. So once a month, the first Friday of each month, we have Theatre Fridays. And it used to be only Guyakanya who was doing that, but we have other groups that have joined, like the Combined Group have joined, the Backstage Theatre has grown, so it's growing and growing. We've also done a project that we want to link to our local history education programs, which is called the Murals Project, where we looked at influential people in Lwandle or local heroes in Lwandle, like Siboniwe Gyegu, who was the first women councillor in Lwandle, Olisi Fakela, who has a section of houses named after him in Lwandle. He was one of the first councillors of Lwandle who unfortunately was murdered in Lwandle. But before he died, he had managed to secure funding from the Rotary Club to have houses built for people of Lwandle. So when he passed away, then a decision was taken to build houses in memory of Fakela. So that area is called Fakela Square. And then we have Mr. Molo, who's one of the people that helped to form the Hostel Dwellers Association to get people houses in Lwandle. He formed the first schools in Lwandle, and he was chairing in one of the government bodies of those schools in Lwandle. He unfortunately passed away earlier this year. And then also people like Ephraim Nyongwana, who was very debatable in the community because in the past he was working as the security police in Lwandle. So we have all those debates in the museum. So what I did when I came to the museum was to try and bring continuity with the exhibitions that we have. So one of the projects that I've been working with is Siyanyanzela, which means we're doing it by force. I traced it back to the history of, if I may call it, revolt of the people of Lwandle, when they moved out of the hostels, moving to places like Umgababa, and then moving to Polile. So it was a way of responding to the treatment that they were getting from the government, because Polile means relaxing. So they went and built their houses to relax, because they wanted to relax from what was happening in the hostels. And then from Polile came Silahliwe, meaning we have been abandoned or rejected. And then you go to places like Nkanini and the recent one, Siyanyanzela, doing it by force. Residents of Siyanyanzela were evicted in 2014. About 986 people were evicted. So I was part of the team that was documenting what was happening there. And so it happened when we were busy trying to develop an exhibition about making home in the post-apartheid South Africa, and this happened. So we decided to focus on the Siyanyanzela exhibition and to do an exhibition about that. And it was a way also, it felt like history repeating itself, because in 1986 there was the petition to have people evicted, and now in 2014 there were letters to have people evicted in Lwandle. So it was history that was repeating itself. That's why we decided to document it. So we are busy working on an exhibition about Siyanyanzela. Blah, 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 blah. Yes. And we've also worked with young people to try and document what was happening there. So they were taking pictures, they were doing interviews on everything that was happening there. I've spoken about the murals projects. We're also doing debates, as I've mentioned, and storytelling workshops. We have a project that is called Digital Storytelling, which we're working with a student from UWC, where we are looking at using pictures and voice to make like a film and then have it published with all the earnings going back to the community and the people who were involved in making the stories. We did a peace walk, I think it was in May this year. There were some incidents that were happening with women abuse, children being abducted and kidnapped and killed and so forth. So we decided to get involved, to ask the schools also to get involved, and we did a peace walk, and we gave a memorandum to the police in Lwandle to say, can you please protect our children? But we also were advising the children how to stay safe on the streets and how to avoid such happening to them. But apart from that, we hold annual Christmas party for orphanages. There is three orphanages that we're working with in Lwandle. So throughout the year, we go around asking for sponsorships, for food, for clothes and everything. And then in December, we have a huge party with the orphans. The museum staff will entertain them. They do face painting, jumping castles and all that. And that is children from as young as 2 months to children as old as 18 years that we do that for. And now in September, we do what we call the heritage competition. We put different tribes in a hat, and then we get schools and community groups. They pick from the hat, and then they have to represent that tribe in food, in attire, and in dance. And then the winners, in the previous year, they went to Robben Island for their spring school. Yes. So, yeah, this year we have a huge trophy that we're going to bring for that. Yes. I think I've said enough. Thank you.
We hope you'll have some questions or comments, reactions for Bongani or Masa. John, do you?
So, as you know, I'm Mark Auslander, the director of this museum, and it's just wonderful to have you here. It's so inspiring hearing about the work of the museum, and of course to meet the whole group. I had two sort of questions. What is in my own work in working with former labor migrants in townships in Lusaka and in the rural areas in eastern Zambia, I've often seen that people's hands, former migrants' hands, become a kind of mobile museum. So much of the storytelling, especially that grandchildren or great-grandchildren will learn, is told through hands. So hands will sometimes be moving like the locomotive. You know, we were going, and then we got close to Francistown, and the big boar came, and he was going stamp, 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 stamp. And he made us see our faces, our past, and then the hands open up, and they become the past. And my brother and I, we were together from the moment we were born, but then we came here, stamp, stamp. And I went this way, and my brother, he went there, and we didn't see each other again. And I'm just wondering, is there a way in the museum to evoke that living quality so that it becomes, it's both the past, but it's now, that somebody of the migrants, when they tell these amazing stories, can convey? Because it's very difficult for children to imagine what these enormous, difficult journeys were like. Mm-hmm. So that's one question I have. And then the second question really comes from our work here in the United States. So my wife Ellen and I, the last several years, have been working very closely around issues of affordable housing. With the museum, we work very closely with Latino labor migrants. And they've undergone a big change from being working in the fruit fields, just the men. They've now become much more sedentary, living in mobile homes. And it's been a difficult process because I think in the museum we want to talk about injustice, we want to show the environmental dangers, and the community, especially the women in the community, they're so proud of the beautiful homes they've created in their interior. So how do we balance wanting to tell the stories of injustice but also honoring the great pride people have in the new homes they've created? So those are some of the things we've been wondering about.
Okay. I see you're running away from answering questions. Some of the things that we do at the museum, it was done in the past, but it was then forgotten and then redone again, which is what we're trying to do now. So we're getting storytellers to come to the museum when we have school groups that are coming to the museum, but also when we have visitors from outside, depending on how much time they have. Then we organize for a storyteller to come. Now the issue of hands, it depends on the passion. It's all about how the story touches the person. And us as Black people, we like using hand gestures to sort of give meaning or to give heart to what we are saying or to show you how it touches us as people. So yes, we are working at that. And with the digital storytelling project that we're doing, that is how we're trying to have videos, because that's one thing that we don't have at the museum. We don't have videos of the people telling their stories. We only have audio, we have pictures, but we don't see the movements that people are making. We don't see the emotions that they are going through while they are telling those stories. So that's what we're trying to do currently at the museum. What was the second question?
The difference between telling the story of migrants and the pride that people have in their homes.
Oh, that is what the Making Home project was looking at. It's a bit of a sensitive issue because you get people who are interested in people's home because they want to learn, but you get people who are interested in people's homes because they want to, I'm not sure of the English word, but bafuna ukoneza into banazo about thina uba singabantu abanjani. Ithini ngesilungu?
All right, let me translate. There is a word in Xhosa that you cannot translate, is Xhosa. Okay, just to add to what my colleague has said, in terms of the gestures that people use and the stories that they tell, because I said I'm dealing with the past of the museum. When we initially discussed the theme of the museum, one of the things we were saying was that maybe the museum will be about Lwandle as a geographical area. But then as we interviewed people, then we realized that their stories kind of transcend these boundaries, because you are interested on their life in Lwandle, and somebody will tell you about Joburg. That when I left home, I went to Joburg, and then from Joburg, I went to Kayamandi, and then we said, let us open it up. Let the thing be broader. Let it be migrant labor, irrespective of where people come from. I don't know, in terms of using hands, how one can capture that, but I think you are making a hint that one must not use audio, but must use audio-visual so that you can capture the gestures. I think that is something that we can learn from, and I don't think it's something that we have done yet, but we take the point. In terms of striking a balance between the hostel being a space of injustice and to some other people being a home. There was an exhibition that the museum did, I think, Bonke, you are free to add because you were also there, where the museum asked people, what does a home mean to you? And people will explain the idea of home. Others will say, my home, because they are migrant laborers, they have another home somewhere in Eastern Cape. Somebody will say, I work here. I do not consider this as home. My home is in the Eastern Cape, where I come from. Others will say, no, I have moved permanently here. This is my home. I do not have another home. So that the museum does not become an authoritative voice about what constitutes a home. The individual stories of what people perceive as home. I think that exhibition is still there, still up. Yeah, stories of home. Yeah. So it draws on those ideas that people have about home. I get the sense that you say that we might think that a sheikh, for example, it's a symbol of oppression, and yet people decorate it and they take pride and they think. But I get very few people who take pride in having sheikhs. If we were to reconstruct the sheikh in the museum, it will become very controversial because people want to get away from it as soon as possible. And even the hostel, when during the hostel to homes project, they were, you know, the hostels were all at some stage looking the same, and then some were restored. When we were saying we are going to keep the hostel, people thought that was ridiculous, because people wanted to get rid of all of that and get something totally new. But then when all the hostels were renovated and they all looked freshly painted and nice, then people started to notice this odd looking hostel, and they started to take pride. And some of them were even taking their children, because that hostel, those hostels were no longer there, to show them that we might be living in a better hostel block now, but this is exactly how they used to look like. So I get the sense that if you have things in abundance, people, they take it as, you know, it's usual. What's the point about it? And then when the stuff is no longer there, then people notice. Yeah. And at some point, Masa, if I can just add without taking your time, most of the visitors, strange enough, who visited the museum were international tourists. They were not locals. And Masa knows that when I visit the museum, even if I don't talk to her, what I do, I go through the visitor's book. Every time I visit, I make a point. And I've seen the change over the years. You used to have a lot of German, American tourists in the early days of the museum. But now it's your local people who are going. School children going there to do assignments. Your local grandpa who's taking the kid to show them the land, the hostel. So the idea of the museum now is changing, because those hostels are no longer there. So the museum kind of compensate for that which is no longer there, and it helps to tell that story. Thank you.
Okay, just one quick question that people might have as a probably in the back of their minds. How many people lived in Lwanle as an area when it was a hostel? And so, you know, tell us a little more about that, the overall community. But just one quick aside that many people, and then I'm gonna look for hands. Often what we've talked about in the United States is a notion of separate spheres, that there's the workplace and that there's the home place. And so in that kind of dynamic, people have wanted homes that are very far away from work. But I assume that the actual factories and other things where people worked at Lwanle were actually very, very close rather than very far. So the idea of a separate sphere, it was very hard to get away from the workplace, because the workplace was very close from what it, could you clarify both the number and how close was the workplace to the actual hostels? Then please do raise your hand so I'll come around to you.
The workplaces were very close to the hostels. It was a walking distance. There were no transportation that was provided for the migrant workers there. So it was about 20-minute walk to where they were working. And the hostels were designed to accommodate 500 men. But over the years, they grew to 3,000 people who were in the hostels, which caused the overpopulation. And today, we're looking about 70,000 people that are in Lwanle.
Hi there. I'm John Ernie Flessner. I'm here at Michigan State. I'm a historian who focuses on Lesotho. And so stories of migration and migrant labor are ever present in the oral histories that I do. If it's not for the individuals I'm talking to, it's for family members. My father went away, my brother went away, my husband goes away, my mother, you know, was gone for 10 years and now she's back. These sorts of things. So I'm wondering how you capture the contemporary dynamic of migrant labor. I think it's great that you're, you know, preserving the hostel. That's a great story, and doing the work with school groups, but how do you capture the narratives of migration that are ongoing, and that are, you know, working with the dynamic of the Lwandoy community in the present period?
Okay. There was one exhibition that we did looking at those issues, the modern day migrant labor issues. And we did that in 2009, where we did an exhibition called the Luandla Designers Exhibition. That's when we looked at what was happening now in Luandla, including everyone who was living in Luandla, and not only people that were coming from the Eastern Cape. So we interviewed people about their daily lives, people who didn't necessarily see themselves as designers. People were just making clothes. The likes of Usindi, Mrs. Molo, and Patronella Chamunoro, who's from Zimbabwe. So we wanted to capture those stories from them. And it was, there were two old people, if I may call them old people, in the exhibition. Most of the designers were young people who got the skill either from their parents or who actually went to school to study the skill. But that's how we documented that. But we're also looking currently to work with young people to hear their stories about migrant labor, because now we have stories of their parents, but we don't know how it affected them. We're also looking at working with the University of Fort Hare to try and trace back what was happening back home in the Eastern Cape while the men were in Luandla. So we're trying to sort of have the two sides of the story, and not only just one, that one-sided story. We want to see what the mother was going through in the Eastern Cape, how she was surviving, how she was raising the kids and so forth, some of the challenges that she was facing. But I think that is going to kick off next year.
Okay, now let me just make sure that everyone understands that there are these perfectly good sign-in sheets. I'm going to send this one around. Do sign in, please. So I'm coming back to Ellen.
Thank you so much. This has been really so interesting and inspirational, thinking about the place of a museum in a social historical context. I'm wondering how it worked, especially with the garden. If you could tell us a bit more about the garden, because the garden seems to provide a shared labor space, both of growing and maintaining the plants, but also of then making the medicines. And I'm just very interested in how that worked, and how did it change people's interactions with each other, and did stories come up, and you know, who are the experts, who are the,
It started off as just an idea that we wanted to do. And then it turned into an education program. So we consulted with some of the older generation that is in Luandla to find out what were some of the medicine that they'll be using, like your Cape aloes and so forth. And we had to learn how to maintain them because none of us has a garden with these traditional medicines. So that's the first thing that we had to learn, how to maintain them, how to mix them and so forth. So we consulted the older generation. We consulted the Department of Education as well to try and see how it's going to fit into the curriculum of the schools. And then people started sharing ideas. And then when the first time we took it to schools, they were not sure what we were doing. It didn't make sense to them. But as soon as it was introduced into the curriculum, and then they started learning about these things, then that's when they started bringing the children to the museum to see the plants, to learn on where does the plant grow normally, what is it used for, what some of the treatments can it provide, and so forth. But it has been very exciting, I must say. But we do have someone who's employed to look after it, to make sure that the plants are in good state. We're doing a... it feels like I'm advertising. We're doing a debate session this Saturday about traditional medicine versus Western medicine. Unfortunately, I won't be there to see how it's going.
But let me just make sure that we recast Ellen's question. I think at the heart of it, when the hostels were at their height, how did the men deal with issues of food? That is, were they only purchasing food, in the local marketplaces? Were they growing their own food? Did they have access to other kind of communal kinds kinds of opportunities, for, say, owning a cow that might be in the hostile area. How did they handle food?
Okay, since I'm dealing with the past and she's dealing with the present and the future, the hostel space, we have aerial photographs in the museum of when it started. That area is not conducive for gardening. It's clay soil. It was chosen deliberately because it was the worst place in the area where you could do anything. So migrant workers wouldn't be able to grow their own food. But the migrant labor system was a well-planned system. There was a shop that was owned by the municipality. So what the migrant workers will do, they will buy food from that shop owned by the local authority to subsidize the entire enterprise of migrants, because the view of the government was that the migrant labor system should pay for itself. So they would get their food from that shop. It was almost like a communist system of some sort. And the other food that men like, alcohol, there was also a beer wall that was built so that when men want to spend their time, they can spend the money in the beer wall. But all that money was subsidizing the hostel system to make sure that it's sustainable on its own. So the opportunities of people doing gardening were very limited because the space is clay. Even now, if it rains and you walk around, it's clay soil. You have to do a lot of interventions to change it into a gardening area. I think when you even started that garden, you had to do, you were telling me the other day that even the lawn, you had to do a lot of interventions. The soil is just not sustainable. Yeah, so the shop was owned by the municipality, the beer wall was owned by the municipality, and I think even the amount of rent, even the water that they had to use, there was a water tank, it was limited, the amount of water that they can use. So that, yeah, and then there was a communal kitchen where all men had to cook their food, and everything was just communal. But my father worked in another hostel, now I'm just getting out of Luandle. AECI, which was a company hostel. There the food was provided by the company. But it was not a gesture of goodwill because the money was docked indirectly from their salaries. In their mind, they thought that the company was providing the meals, but it wasn't really in real sense because they were paid really very low wages, low salaries. So the whole system had to pay for itself.